This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk here. How's everybody doing this evening?
Good. All is well.
Oh, very well. How are you?
Doing fantastic. We've got some fun questions this evening, and we wanted to welcome back Dr. Jen Hawk to the show. Dr. Hawk, welcome. We had a really good time.
Thank you.
Having you on a couple weeks ago, and we've had a couple of shows, and a lot of listeners have emailed me and just really expressed their gratitude that they now have another voice on the show that can expand on these questions
from estrogenized
just a
voice.
Slightly, like you said. What's that?
Estrogenized voice.
Yeah. To explain some of these questions in a more, and just as Dr. Lyle put it, a 13 degrees, a little bit different scenarios or different answers. So
sometimes
we really appreciate
180.
That. Now, sometimes 180, exactly. And
sometimes, very, very often 180. Yeah. But it's more, pretty much on the mark more often than not. So yeah, it's always interesting to see where things wind up.
All good.
Well, and we did have, I think, like one or two listeners that just expressed some of their disagreeability with some of their emails.
Of course.
Yes. And so I think what we have to say to them is in the famous words of Thumper from Bambi is the following.
If you can't say something nice, don't say nothing at all.
All good.
Oh, very sound wisdom for the ages. Yes, that's like the mantra of pseudo esteem, really. Yeah. Well, that and, you know, you can't please all of the people all of the time. That's a good one too. So it's a good reminder that there's a wide spectrum of personalities and you know, some people are gonna like a little variety and some people aren't, and that's totally fine. So no
it's
worries.
All good. We're all here to have the good time and have some fun. So, and in the words of Dr. Lyle, who was also saying in the words of, I forgot who Dr. Lyle, but the whole never criticize nobody. Is it an Italian mobster that said that? Or
no,
was it,
that was my friend,
else?
Larry Gitlin. That he
oh God, basically an Italian mobster.
A Jewish Italian mobster. The Larry's attitude was that there's really no CB in criticism. It was a very, very interesting insight, particularly from somebody who's very critical. but it's actually an interesting insight, and particularly I have a young lady who's just starting a new job. She's very bright, and she's also got a serious disagreeable streak, and she knows it. So with her high intelligence and high conscientiousness, she's recognizing she has to be disciplined because the natural disagreeable wants to criticize. And so she's doing a really good job here in her second week of holding it together, recognizing this. She's beating her genes, knowing full well that, you know, once she gets better established socially and they understand her competence, which they're already seeing, then she's going to have more latitude and she doesn't have to be in any rush. If there's a need to criticize something, she can do that 6 months from now. So, yeah, just in general, criticism is criticism is in general a dangerous activity unless I'm doing it, at which point it's fully justified. All right. Let's go on, Nathan. Let's see what we got.
All right. Fantastic. Well, we've got a few questions here, and we're going to actually, this first question, Dr. Lyle, I'd like you to answer it first, mm-hmm. and then we'll take Dr. Hawk's take on it. So
okay.
This is called Couch Surfing as a Woman. Mm. Dear Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, my niece and I have been debating whether it's safe for attractive young solo female travelers to couch surf. She believes that a careful reading of a host's couch surfing profile enables her to spot would-be predators. What are your thoughts on this, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk?
Well, you know, that's such a Jen Hawk question that I'm just going to completely punt. There's really no reason for me to be in this question. So, Jen, you go right ahead.
Well, I suspect we might disagree on it, which is interesting because we have very different levels of openness. I don't think we disagree on the fundamentals of it. So this is a question near and dear to my heart. I was one of probably the very first members of Couchsurfing.com when it went live way back in like the late 90s. You know, it was a miraculous thing that came about. I couldn't believe that such a thing would exist for a 90th percentile open person. And so I use couchsurfing.com and a lot of sites like it, all these, you know, different farm work trades and work exchanges and all kinds of different ways of traveling all around the world for free for many, many years. And I, you know, got myself into some pretty hairy situations. There are definitely some negative experiences that came out of it, but nothing too terrible. And I think overall, it's totally worth the trade as long as you keep your eyes open and you're paying attention and you're using your judgment. And I think these things have come so far where now you can really, you know, I would never couch surf, or I would never make some kind of work exchange with anyone who hadn't been verified by the site and had some reviews, you know, kind of just use discretion and discernment just like you would with an Airbnb or buying something on Amazon or anything else. There's a lot of information available for what kind of experience you're getting yourself into. And I think overall, if you're going to someone who's well-established on one of these sites, who's hosted a lot of people and has positive reviews and photos and all of that, it's almost certainly going to be a positive experience. The other thing I would add to that is to have, you know, one of the things I do regret from all of my crazy adventuring around the world is I never had a very good backup plan. I would get myself into the worst situations that I was in were bad in large part, because I was sort of stuck with them. There were places I would have really liked to get out of, but I didn't have enough money on a credit card to go get a hotel, for example, if things really hit the fan. So I would just advise her to be a little smarter than I was and have a good plan B and go have the adventure. But if it turns sour, have a good backup plan, let people know where you are, and save the money and have the experiences where you can. But as a principle, for an open person who wants adventures, go for it.
I would totally agree with all that, right down to reiterating that you want to be in a position of power, and you don't want to be walking into any situation where anybody can sniff vulnerability on you. And so that's a critical issue. And so at the first sign of trouble, don't be making a cost benefit on $80. You know, if there's first sign of trouble, you just get out immediately. And so that would be the one mistake that somebody might make, would be to be hemming and hawing and shuffling one foot to another after somebody's already showed their hand that they've got, you know, problematic personality. So first sign of trouble, just leave and you're done. See you later. And if we leave quickly, the escalation won't be that great. That's the idea.
Definitely situations where I was managing really disagreeable, really unstable people because I just didn't have a choice. There was nowhere else that I could go. I had to wait it out until my flight in 2 days or whatever it was, when way better to go take care of yourself. So yes, but happy adventuring. My openness is jealous.
Yeah. All good. All right.
Fascinating. All right. Well, our next question is about resilience, and this is for both of you, but mainly Dr. Jen Hawk because of your work in trauma. So, dear doctors, can you please talk about what resilience is with regards to personality in the Big Five? A little background. I recently attended a multi-day training for work. which was focused on trauma-informed care. And I found myself rolling my eyes throughout almost the entire thing. It seemed like the suggestions that the trainers would put forth for making an agency, quote, trauma-informed, end quote, were just really fancy ways of telling us that we should coddle people to death. For example, one trainer went into a 5-minute dissertation about how a, quote, no cell phone sign in a courthouse lobby is not trauma-informed because the word no would trigger people. I hope you agree that this suggestion is insane. There also seemed to be an extreme overestimation of what experiences should be considered traumatic. And I'm concerned that we are doing more damage by telling people that they have been traumatized by what are probably just moderately stressful life experiences. So the question is, do you think that it's possible to help people develop a trait of resilience or grit?
I'll let Jen talk, and then we talk a great deal about these issues between the two of us. So I think we have very similar perspectives. But go ahead, Jen, wind out on this, and let's give them whatever you feel like giving them.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's an enormous topic, and we have been talking about this a lot in sort of all of its different permutations. But the question seems to really be focusing on, you know, is it possible to build resilience, or where does resilience come from? Which was actually that was the question that animated my whole my graduate work, my dissertation is about indigenous responses to climate change in the Arctic, and I was very curious about what made certain communities more so-called resilient to that challenge than others, and what kinds of institutions could be incorporated into those communities to build resilience, and what was eroding resilience, et cetera, and there are huge literatures on this, and it's very much part of the policy thinking in Alaska and elsewhere that you can create systems that encourage resilience and protective factors and all of these things. And you know, as I got into that research, and this is a much bigger topic probably even than we could get into if we devoted the whole show to it, but as I got into it, I really kind of had to confront the fact that resilience, like anything else, like anything that we would want to talk about, would be it's where personality meets an individual cost-benefit analysis. So we could describe different ways that resilience might appear in the Big Five, but I would be really hesitant to do that because I think people would get over-invested in that and measure their various personality aspects on the Big Five and determine whether they're resilient or not. It's a dynamic situation that's context-dependent on the general situation. And I think that the questioner has a really good intuition here where they're talking about that there's more damage being done with these kinds of coddling things, like no is a triggering word or whatever. That this, I totally wholeheartedly agree with this question that this is really out of control and has gotten pretty ridiculous. And I think that the cost of that and the damage that is being done there is that it's lowering the social cost of avoiding competition, which is a process that is going to undermine self-esteem. That's really what's going on, is that the more you can kind of fall back into these coddling type things and these triggered environments and these safe spaces, it's irritating to people who have sort of more conscientiousness, more responsibility, want more impulse for that self-responsibility. But the real problem is that it's at odds with the self-esteem process. And so that's why we should really care about it and pay attention to it when we might be getting sucked into it ourselves. Oh, you're going to hear my dogs on this podcast. My dogs are talking in the background. So they're not in a safe space, apparently. So like self-esteem is the whole game, and anything like this that is really putting up barriers to that is something that's worth paying attention to. And so I think when we're talking about how to build resilience, how do we encourage resilience and grit, that's actually by participating fully in the competitive reality that's in front of us, whatever that is, confronting those fundamentals of the difficult tasks that we might prefer to avoid, and discovering what your capacity for improvement in those fundamentals and in that competitive task is. That's where that's where pride and self-esteem and ultimately what we would think of as resilience come from, not by protecting people or by creating safe spaces for them or by, you know, making sure that we're not triggering anybody into kind of microaggression or anything like that. I think this is also profoundly misguided. And so I'm in intellectual solidarity with the questioner here.
Absolutely fabulous. Just right on target. From my perspective, this she and I agree completely down the line on this. This is a there's just a few tiny little things that I would parse that have nothing to do other than with slight little linguistic nitpicking. And that is, the notion is I don't think we're doing damage by this kind of trauma pandering. I think, and I don't think Jen would say so either, what we're doing, though, is we are derailing people's cost-benefit to attempt to engage the world in a reasonably competitive fashion, exactly as she's saying. So but we are in agreement with what the questioner is saying completely. You know, this is... The whole trauma concept is, I had a name for it 20 years ago. I called it bruised banana theory. And it's the idea that the human person is like a banana. You're trying to get it ripe. And every time that someone like squeezes the banana, picks it up in the store or at home, you bruise it a little bit. And so it can't be the banana that it was otherwise going to be. And so the notion from both Freudian psychology and learning theory is the notion that harmful or hurtful little experiences, in other words, hurtful processes, are seen as harmful processes. That's the notion. This is a just profound mistake, and it's also a very seductive one, and it's it essentially has led to. Jen's analysis of this that people will be seeing in print and in other places in the future, this has led to essentially a cultural wide phenomenon of the payoff is to bitch and complain and whine and blame other people for our competitive struggles and our competitive basically our being intimidated by the competitive realities that we face, and essentially wanting to cry foul and say that it's not fair. And this has gone, you know, hypertrophic to the point where we can't say no cell phones in a courthouse. It's like, oh, you know, any possible advantage over anything that we could possibly bitch about now becomes a leverage of which to essentially carve out some kind of an advantage and get some kind of compensation of some kind. It is absurd. And all I can think of is, you know, this is the same species where 19-year-old boys got into boats and headed for the coast of Normandy under withering German fire. It's the same species. Like, how is that even possible? That's the same species. And the answer is that we have a cultural phenomenon where bitching and whining and complaining and moaning and pointing fingers pays off in a way that it has never paid off before. And so that's why you get the absurdity that you've got. And it's a total and utter fiasco. And I was just simply personally disgusted with it. And I believed that I was going to go to my grave shrugging my shoulders, disgusted. But because of Dr. Hawk, I will go to my grave disgusted but informed. So thank you.
Yeah. Oh, anytime. I like to blend disgust with, you know, an education.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing.
I've got a question to expand on this. Now, I, of course, agree with you both in every single way. But from one perspective, I can imagine that, for example, you got a little soccer team of, you know, little kids and a coach is there. And this is where, when I was a kid, nobody got trophies unless you won. And then as you started getting older, now there was a few people, parents and coaches that were like, oh, well, if we don't give the kids, everybody a participation trophy, then maybe they're not going to want to play anymore. And then if they're not going to want to play anymore, then how are they going to earn their own esteem and work hard? And so I guess from that perspective, they might say, well, you know, we coddle them so that we're careful so that they can continue to compete. And so to that you say,
that's incredible. This is understand that there are, I don't know that I quite finished this, but the notion that pain and suffering and struggle are damaging to the organism is ridiculous. And so the children are going to lose many, many, many competitions in their life. Losing is part of the game. It's the only way that the organism can calibrate its capabilities and therefore wind up targeting its efforts towards value propositions in competitive arenas that is appropriate for its abilities. That's how you find out that you're out of your weight class. Okay, so this is what information is. It's critical information in order to calibrate. You got to play and lose. The way you learn how to walk is you try and then you fall. That's how it's done. The way you learn how to talk is you try to imitate the sounds and fail. And then by the failure feedback that comes through the system, you correct and you learn and you grow. So the notion that the best life, that you could live a happy life as a 35-year-old adult by virtue of having had the least possible amount of upsettedness or inconvenience or unpleasantness or negative feedback, that sets you up for the best adult life in all the years post 35 by your banana not having been bruised by discomfort and defeat. That is insane. Okay? That is an unbelievable vision of human nature that comes right through Freudian and learning theory. Literally, the two giant theories of psychology of the 20th century are both utter failures in this regard. And they engineer precisely what Jen is talking about that we don't want, which is that we don't want to be essentially mollycoddled and rewarded in any way for the bitching, whining, and complaining, and et cetera. That instead what we want is we want people to understand that there are three pillars of human life satisfaction. Those are self-esteem, self-confidence, and then finally the achievement of victories. That's what they are. So there's self-esteem is the internal audience's observation of your efforts. It's effectively a moral compass inside your nervous system that feeds you a feeling of pride that comes with your excellent effort. And if you do a lousy effort, it tells you you're doing a lousy effort. If you do so-so, it gives you so-so. And if you work very hard and prepare very well and work hard at it, it gives you excellent internal feedback. Self-confidence is entirely different, but people confuse the two. They confuse self-esteem with everything. They confuse self-esteem with self-confidence, and they confuse self-esteem with achievement. So people believe that if you give people evidence of achievement, of victory, by giving them a trophy, somehow this causes the banana to somehow have a coating of shellac around it that protects it against all the bruises that might come from future defeats or inconveniences or negative feedback. This is ridiculous. This is not how any of this is engineered. It does not improve confidence at all. Confidence is the result of your own internal system monitoring the results of your excellent efforts and watching to see if you've improved in your knowledge or abilities. That's the only place that confidence comes from is from your internal observation of your improvement of your body or your mind. That is the only place that confidence comes from. It comes from nowhere else. Okay? And finally, the last part of it is achievement itself, which has to take place in the arena of natural competitive processes. When you win, it's great. When you lose, it sucks. That's how it is. Okay? But the notion that if you lose, that it damages your self-esteem is ridiculous. That's a misunderstanding of the self-esteem mechanism. It will reduce your confidence, as it should. See, people forget that unhappiness and depression are every bit as important as signals to the human life and their ability of an organism to survive, as is joy and excitement. They're evolutionarily equal. Okay? So, of course, what we want to do is encourage people to compete. We do not want to be giving them a tricky little low-grade phony pass by trauma pandering, which is what all this BS is. So I'm disgusted. Jen's enlightening me, and we're getting better by the day is what's happening.
A practical example of this is a couple of weeks ago, Dr. Lyle, you and I and Dr. Goldhammer and a gentleman by the name of Toby were at Chef AJ's conference in Las Vegas, and we all went to go play basketball.
Yeah.
Now, for our listeners that don't know, Dr. Lyle, Dr. Goldhammer play basketball regularly. They have for a while. And I've maybe played, you know, a total of 45 minutes in my entire life of basketball.
Yeah.
And so I went to play because I wanted to, you know, wanted to get my ass kicked. So I went and I made a few mistakes. A lot of mistakes cost me and Dr. Lyle playing on the same team, cost him a couple points. And as I'm like blubbering over myself, apologizing, Dr. Lyle, you told me, no worries, you're brand new to this. Yeah. And all of a sudden, a little switch hit in my head where I said, oh, that means I can try as hard as I want to because I'm brand new and there's only one way to go, which is up. Mm-hmm. And so it's just a really fascinating, you know, set of words that you said to me, and I've taken that with a lot of other things. It's if we're brand new to things, we're how can we expect to be good at them?
Absolutely, that's what the process of struggle is about, is to learn, and then as you get better, which you did in literally minutes, you know, as you started to understand it, because you're a fine athlete, and as soon as you started to understand some of the things that needed to happen. You know, we didn't have enough time, but we were going to beat those guys, as you saw. we were getting more effective by the minute.
But most importantly, you're watching yourself improve. The process of watching yourself improve and that increased self-efficacy, that really is with resilience and self-esteem and self, it's all of it is tied together because you have now participated fully in this process without trying to duck out or slither around some sort of competitive end run and not actually participate. So you're actually in there, you're watching yourself improve, you're realizing that there's a delta there, and that's actually the secret sauce.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, one thing that we've talked about before is this concept of results-oriented thinking. Is that I guess what you're saying, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk, is that if you put in your full effort, even if you lose, you've still got some self-esteem there.
Yes.
Question.
Yes. You still. That's what. Yes. That, yes. The self-esteem is independent of the outcome.
And this is the. You know, this is some of the beauty of Eastern philosophy. This is a big point of what the Buddhists are trying to, they're trying to send us a message here. I think they, in general, try to go too far. In other words, they'll try to say it's all process and no outcome. And so I think there's a tendency to want to try to sell it too far. But I have to say that going at least halfway or three quarters. In other words, really the notion is we have our eye on the goal and we would love victory. And so we want to win, obviously. But the biggest thing that we want to win is the self-respect that comes with having given an excellent effort. It really is not about winning and losing. It's about how you play the game. And so, you know, this is, that's from our standpoint, that's the most critically misunderstood and underestimated control switch in human happiness that exists. And it's very difficult as a human.
Yes. Yeah. And you have total control.
Yeah, go ahead, Jen.
No, I was just adding to that it's the most important switch that exists, and you have total control over it. You can turn it on and off whenever you want. You are in charge.
Yes. So what you have is you have 100% indirect control over one of the most important foundations of your life experience. The fact that you have such control over this is not really well recognized. It's vaguely recognized, and it's come in hundreds of different messages from scholars and theologians and, you know, across the centuries. But we're now mapping this down into a consilient argument that goes down deep into human evolution. You're designed to try to compete those competitions, if you opt out of those competitions, then there is cheap currency that awaits you on the other side of a trauma complaint. And the best currency that life has to offer is actually the self-esteem that comes from knowing you gave your very best shot to something. And win or lose, you know, there's a beautiful phrase from a movie that I loved, which is called Hard Times. And the phrase was, like old mama says, the next best thing to playing and winning is playing and losing. And that's how we want to look at life.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating.
All right.
Well, our next set of questions are about relationships. Mm-hmm. So we're going to turn the ship a mm-hmm. little bit. Dear Dr. Lyle, dear Dr. Hawk, I dated a guy for about 5 years who would never commit and cheated on me several times. Though I did not learn of his indiscretions until after the relationship ended, I recently found out that he married one of the women who he cheated on with me after dating her for only a brief time. My initial reaction to this was to laugh because his new wife is quite a bit less attractive than I am. She weighs probably about 25 to 30 pounds more than I do. She has a bit of a gummy smile, etc. After the hilarity wore off, I realized...
No. Go ahead, sorry.
No, seriously.
Go ahead.
After the hilarity wore off, I realized that I felt a little bit annoyed that my ex-boyfriend would marry this gal after such a short time, but wasted so many years giving me the runaround. After our split was all said and done, I definitely felt like I came out with the better end of the deal, and luckily I'm now in a relationship that has major magic 10% potential. But my question is, why am I still so irritated about my loser ex's quickie marriage?
Yeah, I got a few thoughts about this, Jen, but I just assume you to take a pass at it. I'm always curious about what you're thinking.
Yeah, well, I have a couple thoughts too, but my first thought is if you're in a relationship that has magic 10% potential now, you should really, you know, focus your energy on that and really do your best to let the loser go. You're understandably irritated, and you know, you're irritated because you lost a prize there to some degree, and you also have a little bit of an open loop because you're confused, because you're looking at this and you feel objectively more attractive, and this just is not fair and right in the universe, and what went wrong here. But this happens all the time. The qualification process for pair bonding is it's a mysterious process, and you can't predict, from your perspective, who would qualify for someone else, even if you've been with them, even if you know them very well. This is not a left-brained process. This is not a rational process. This is a very mystical, right-brained, mysterious process. So just because you're objectively more attractive and this person weighs more and has a gummier smile or whatever it is that we're being critical about, you have no idea like what she has that you don't have. You don't know what his different thresholds and specific ideals for personality and conversation and brains are, what circuits she's hitting that you don't. You don't know how she smells to him. You don't know what that experience, like how their immune systems are talking to each other. There's so many different little pieces of this that you could just never anticipate. And so it's, I would just, you know, Let go and let God, and this is what it is, and he found his magic 10%. You've possibly found your magic 10%. That's where you should be investing your time and energy and hoping for the best there and doing everything you can to create your own happily ever after.
Yeah.
That would be my
sure.
general
I think
take.
That I think that what we're seeing is that she feels insulted, and the insultant is she's confused. And I think that, again, whenever we hear anger, we know that there's an inference of unfairness. And the unfairness is, in this case, I think it's winding around. It's not just that she lost this specific individual. I think it's the fact that in a Stone Age village, if this had happened, there would be a pretty serious calculus, social calculus threat that she would be facing. that in other words, if she got dumped by this guy for that female, everybody says she should be in principle more valuable than that other female. What is it about her that she's carrying a liability around that we don't know about? So this would actually be right. So there's a village inference of what I would call her internal ugliness. That this is, he's essentially saying there was something wrong with her that you guys don't know about. And I think that she's looking at herself thinking, no, that's not true. There isn't anything weird about me. And yet that's what it would look like to the village. And so therefore this is a threat to my mate value, and it's making me insecure. It's essentially a social cost, and I'm pissed off. Okay. So you can imagine the other direction, you know, that people live through where the next mate is fancier than you. And it's like, okay, well, it's somewhat embarrassing that I got beat, but it's fair enough. Okay. And so that's the other side of this equation.
Yeah. See, maybe it's the disagreeable side of me, but if I got broken up with in this way, I would look at it and be like, oh, well, she's probably more disagreeable than I am, so she roped him in. Or if she's less attractive than I am, then and chances are he's just being lazy, so it's a lot easier. He gets a lot better feedback, and so, you know, there we go.
This is the Goldhammer inference, okay? So this is...
It totally is.
This is like, if they went for something other than me, then they're just too lazy and they don't want to put up with the fact that my standards right. would have been too high.
Yeah. Something wrong with them.
Right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. I love that. That's beautiful.
You'll go far, Nate.
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, my comment was going to end with, what is it about human nature? Because I know that, like, just from my talkings with other people, that my views on that is slightly unusual. So I was going to ask, what is it about human nature that people are looking at, how the village is going to look at them versus what I just described?
Yeah, I think that.
Yeah, well,
go ahead. What do you think of Jen?
Yeah, no, I mean, they're always concerned about how the village is sizing up this situation and what their relative standing is and how they're going to go forward competitively. I mean, I have been in this situation and sort of had these same inferences in the same exact circumstances. And you spend a lot of time kind of computer checking with your girlfriends, trying to figure out like what you are missing and what is it about her. And then you kind of land on these narratives like you're describing, Nate, where it's like, well, it must just be that, you know, it's that she's more disagreeable and she tricked him or whatever it is. That's the kind of information that you're looking to get back from the village to quiet that voice in your head that there is the internal ugliness that Dr. Lyle is talking about. So this is a back and forth process of your own soul searching and your computer checking with the village to make sure that you're still in a good position for the next potential mate that would come along.
Yeah. And yeah, I would add to that, or what's being inferred there, is that you're not just computer checking, you're also selling. So you're trying to figure out the best way to play this, because this is game theory. So you've got to figure out what's in your best interest. Do we say that he's lazy shit, that he doesn't really want to, you know, to go to the effort of continuing to qualify for somebody as outstanding as me? Or do we say, I don't know what's wrong with him, he's got something wrong with him? Or do we say, hey, who the hell knows? Maybe she's really just really sweet, you know, and hey, good for him. I.e. we take the high ground and shrug our shoulders. Like there's a whole bunch of what you're looking at is some bunch of social instincts in here. And there's a variety of options. There's a menu of games to be played. And every situation is going to be a little different, but probably the dominant feature of the situation will be the individual's personality. And so, you know, Alan will immediately go to, hey, they're, you know, what's wrong with them? Something wrong with them, and I'm glad to be done with them. Like that's in 2 seconds, that's what's coming back. And I mean, that's what he really feels.
Yeah. But that's part of the game theory, is if they're so terrible, then what was I doing with them for 2 or 3 years? You know, how did I not see it? Maybe there is something wrong with me for not seeing it or for putting up with that. And so, yeah, there's a lot of gamesmanship and a lot of going back to the earlier question about triggers and trauma and ways to avoid competition. Like sometimes it is the best out for you is to blame some external force for his change in priorities and behavior. Oh, he has intimacy issues. You know, he couldn't really commit to me because he has this damage from his childhood. He's a super bruised banana. And she doesn't ask that of him. And so he's happier with her. So narratives like that are going to come in that save face for you and, you know, keep your status intact in the village and allow you to move forward with your other relationships.
Yeah. Complicated.
Fascinating.
You bet.
All right. Well, I've got to look at my own menu.
It's not your fault, Nate. You all learned right. it at Alan's knee when you worked for him. That's him. That's it.
Oh, yeah.
You were a nice guy when you came there.
Yeah.
Oh, my. All right.
Then I got taught how it
yeah,
should be
it.
Done.
That's it.
All right. Dear Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, I contracted herpes from a long-term boyfriend who was cheating on me about 10 years ago. Now, I find this so difficult to share this information with a new person that I'm dating. I'm 50 years old and reasonably attractive, but I haven't really been dating from shame regarding this condition. Your straight talk suggestions are very helpful in this podcast, and I'm wondering if you can advise me on how to best frame my situation for myself, my status, and any potential mates in the future.
Yeah, a nice question. It's perfect for us having a couple of different takes that might be slightly different. So let's give them the nice person's version, which is Jen's. So yeah, what comes to mind for you?
Yeah. I would generally, you know, it's completely understandable that she feels this way, and it's but I wouldn't feel obligated to lead with it on dates. You know, you can kind of quiet this initially. It's like people will sometimes have this idea that they've got this big piece of baggage, and so they better just, you know, lay it all out on the table right away. And I don't think she needs to do that and burden herself with that expectation. She can get herself into the 10 paid dates process with somebody who looks like they might be a good contender, and then we can think about how we're going to bring this up with this guy. And you know, in the event that it seems like it's going to be a relevant thing to bring up, I would just advise her to, you know, kind of take a very very matter-of-fact approach, and you know, I am struggling with this. It's a pretty common thing. I've got it well managed. I just really feel like this is potentially going somewhere with you, and I want to be upfront about it. But to bring it up at the appropriate time in the establishment of that little blossoming pair bond, not to scare him away too early, and then also not to sit on it forever and never mention it. So it's a little bit of an art and a science. But yeah, there's no reason to be intimidated by this. It's not that uncommon. It can be well managed with medication, and just to kind of go at it with that matter of fact attitude and not make it a big deal would be my general take. But I'm nicer than you are.
It's right on target. I would add this to this problem and related similar problems. And
other pieces of dirty laundry.
Yeah, the my brother-in-law, who's now passed away, was a superb litigator, and so sometimes he was in position of defending clients as well as, you know, as well as prosecuting a position, and so he said that the best move that he found when you had some vulnerability in a case was what he called confess and avoid, which is Jen is describing this, which is be matter of fact. So it's not like we're going to say, well, we got to light 14 candles now, and I really got some big secret I got to tell you, and I'm really embarrassed about
it. I've really got something to tell you. Yeah, don't do that.
Yeah, the attitude is, hey, you know, if they're asking, well, where were you on the night that, you know, your spouse was murdered, you know, it's like,
hey, you know, I was in a cabin in the woods by myself. Oh, nobody saw you go there. You know what? I got to tell you, I was out there all by myself and nope, nobody saw me. In other words, we have this attitude of, yeah, I mean, this is how it is. So what? Okay.
Yeah, what do you do about it?
And that's, so that's how I would approach anything like this. Like, yes, it's some baggage. It's part of being an adult in the real world. Things happen. It's not a catastrophe at all. But I want to be responsible. And as Jen would say, you know, you share this at an appropriate time, all's good. And that's, and I don't put it this way. If you do this in this way and it's a big problem, good. Because that individual just ruled themselves out. Yeah, that's exactly how we look at that. Yeah, i.e., we play the game the right way, and if however it turns out, we're at peace with it.
And I believe now there are dating websites for people who have, you know, HIV, herpes, all these other things, so that, you know, you meet people where that's already common between you two.
Yeah, but herpes is so common. It's like, this is like having had, you know, a bad string with your credit 7 years ago. It's like, hey, no problem. Okay. It's like, this is something that people have to be in the dating world, have to be completely prepared to deal with as a very normal piece of baggage. It's like finding out somebody's got a dog. You know, it's like, hey, I got a dog.
Oh, God. God forbid. Or two dogs.
Well, we're going to get emails about that. That's for sure. We're going to eventually do a show with all the funny emails that I get and just have a big laugh.
That's
so
good. All right. Maybe one
all
more?
Right. We've got one more. Yeah, we got one more, but I was wondering, we have a caller that's been on hold that I've asked what the question's about, and it seems like a pretty reasonable question, so I think we can knock it out. What say you? You want to do this week or next week?
No, we'll do it. We'll do our caller right now, and I'll take the caller, and then Jen can piggyback in as it makes sense. Let's go ahead.
Well, we are going to welcome to the show Jennifer, and Jennifer, welcome to the show. Thank you for calling.
Thank you very much. I'm going to say good morning to all of you. It's about almost 5:30 in the morning for me.
Oh my goodness!
From London.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. I know.
Good
morning.
So
thank you
London.
Very much for taking my call.
You bet.
And thank you for everything you've done for me. I've been following you for a long time, and you've made a huge difference in my life, Dr. Lyle. And I am eternally grateful. So thank you. Thank you very much. You've given me health and sanity, which I particularly need now. I have two children, 14 and 16, and my 16-year-old was diagnosed with epilepsy in February. And I sort of have two questions about it. One is sort of my own stress level. I am a hyperconscientious nutcase, and my son was put on academic probation through his school in the spring. He's at an independent school, and he has some learning difficulties, but really he struggled a bit last year, obviously, because he was having a lot of seizures before it was more well-controlled. And I've got stress around that. I'm worried they're going to ask him to leave the school. And I think the other thing is I'm anxious about his health. He had two seizures last week. And it's one of those things where, you know, the boxes with the arrows and you run, like, what's the worst thing that could happen? And, at this point, like, the worst that could happen is, you know, he could have a seizure at the top of an escalator where it was, and he's getting ready to go on the underground, and, he could die. And so I guess I have a question about him, but then as far as, like, managing my own stress, if you have any suggestions for me.
Well, I have a few things to think about that. And that is that what we want to be is we want to make sure that we've done our homework to be as informed as we can, and that we have consulted. We've done a good job at consulting, you know, the best minds that we can afford to talk to make sure that we've covered every base. So this is an example of this is a
sort of a deep game that we're playing with our self-esteem mechanism. So what we're trying to do is make sure that no matter what happens, even if you know, God forbid, we have a tragedy, if we do, we want to look back at whatever that tragedy is and know that we did an excellent job at preparing as best we possibly could, so that we do less second guessing if things go wrong. That's all we can do. And so I would say that I don't know, obviously, what your circumstances are in terms of, and I don't know what experts there are in London. I would certainly have consulted more than one about medications, treatment, as well as what things need to be prepared for. I would also probably look at the scientific literature. What's your own personal education level, Jennifer?
Yeah, I have a master's degree, so.
Okay, good. Perfectly able to read science. Okay, so I would make sure that I had read quite a bit, not quote on the internet, but I'd actually looked at scientific journals themselves. And the if I didn't understand the stats, I would pay $30 an hour to some stat whiz online to help me decipher and understand so that I could read the journals. And I would make sure that I had read enough that I understood where, for example, the very biggest problems were with epilepsy, where were the places where people got into serious trouble, where were the preventable things, so that, you know, this is a very big threat. It's not huge. People live, you know, I don't know what percentage of people die from seizures, but it's not a small percentage, but neither is it dominant. Okay. So, but I would certainly, if it was my child, you can count on that I would probably put in, 300 hours of research out of my life, which is not some ridiculously high amount. It's a couple of months of essentially full-time work over the course of a year. That would be what, 6 hours a week for a year. So I would probably put in that kind of time, not rushing through it, be diligent, essentially like a personal homework assignment, where I would be chipping away at becoming more and more knowledgeable, not flailing around, just grabbing onto an expert, but actually becoming informed myself. I'm actually aiming at a little issue here. A book that I would read would be Anatomy of an Epidemic by Whitaker. The reason why I'd read that book is that my reading of that book, which was published in 2011, indicated that the medications for seizures were not effective. Okay, that long-term, people were not better off with those medications, and that they had damaging effects on the brain, just like everything else in psychopharm. So I can't tell you that that's true because I haven't investigated that literature personally. But if my child had a major seizure disorder, my nose would be in Mr. Whitaker's book. I'd be looking at those citations, and I would be following those up and make sure that I had enough understanding of the math, which is not complicated, but you might need some assistance with it, so that you can grasp and not be taking things from an expert opinion. Instead, we're taking them directly from the scientific investigations themselves. Okay? This is my friend, Colin Campbell, had a cancer in his family that was extremely upsetting for him. And he had to roll up his shirt sleeves and do a fairly exhaustive analysis of that particular cancer, what was known about the treatments, etc. As he went through the process with the family member, he was discovering at every step of the way that he was much better informed than the people that were treating her, okay, and that they were going to make mistakes. And he would then confront them gently. If you know Colin Campbell, he is a consummate gentleman. And the responses back from medical professionals was very interesting, mostly very hostile. One lady began to cry because it turned out that she actually knew he was right. And she had told him wrong, but she had done it because it was the status quo. So this was a very interesting process that he went through. It turns out the family member now 10 years later is doing totally well. They're fine. They were very, very conservative in their treatment. They did not do the recommended treatments. They were not indicated on the basis of the science, but they were indicated on the basis of the standard treatment protocols, which were not lining up with the science. So this is all by way of me telling you, I do not know what the best way it is to proceed, because I'm not a professional that knows anything about epilepsy, but I am someone that knows about the self-esteem mechanism. And you've got enough IQ and you got plenty of time, and we're not in a dire emergency right this second. What we need to do is a steady, methodical, non-rushed, exhaustive, and unbiased examination of the literature yourself, to the point where you feel like you know that you're doing this job to the best of your ability. Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense. And I love homework, so I'm all
yes.
over it.
Yes. If you run into trouble, if you run into obstacles along the way, and you need assistance to interpret literature, please feel free to write to me or give me a call, and I will walk my way through it as best to my ability, and if we need to seek other assistance, we will. Okay?
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely, Jennifer. Thank you for calling.
Okay. Bye-bye. Have a good day.
Bye.
Jennifer, thank you for the wonderful call and the wonderful question. All right, Dr. Hawk, Dr. Delisle, it's been a pleasure. We had a wonderful show, and we're looking forward to a couple more. So thank you guys for coming on, as always.
Fantastic. Thank you, Nathan. Gotcha.
Yeah, anytime.
Bye.
Thanks, Nate. Good night.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.